in the height of the wedding season and more wine glasses are being raised in toasts than almost at any other time of year. Well, wine writer Natalie McLean recently did a piece called The Merry Widows of Mousse. Now, she wasn't writing about pastry cooks. She was writing on a side of champagne that we haven't heard a lot about. Natalie writes a wine e-newsletter called Nat Decants. Hey, Natalie, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am good. So, The Merry Widows of Mousse. Now, the mousse is the foam on the champagne, but what about the female connection? What about the widows?
Well, it's a fascinating story because as I dug into it, I realized that some of the best and most well-known brands in the world of champagne were actually either started or built to their peak in terms of production by young women at the turn of the 18th and 19th centuries.
That's interesting because talk about a period where women would not have had that kind of power.
Absolutely. At that time, there were few women in business at all. But these women were heading up what were, for the time, France's largest companies. And the champagnes still bear their names. If we think about Veuve Clicquot and Pommery and Laurent Perrier, Roederer and Bollinger, those were women who were in their 20s and 30s at that time period, the 18th, 19th centuries, running these places.
And they ran them because their husbands had passed away.
Absolutely. Like, their husbands had either died in one of the wars or they died due to illness. Veuve Clicquot, for example, her husband died of malignant fever in 1805. And she was left 27 years old with an 8-year-old daughter and a champagne house to run.
And she had no experience in this.
No, she didn't. Most of these women were either playing supporting roles or they really weren't involved in the champagne making or running of the business until their husbands passed away. And so they weren't expected to take over. They were expected maybe to turn over the reins to a cousin or a nephew or to sell the business because they came from wealthy families. Selling the business would have provided a nice little income, but they didn't. They stepped up and started running these champagne houses.
So tell me the story about Veuve Clicquot. You should know, guys, that Veuve means widow in French, right? Right, Natalie?
It does, yeah. Yes. And yeah. So we see Veuve on a lot of the different champagne bottles.
So what did she do?
Well, okay, so it was 1805, and her husband has just passed away. And as I said, she's just 27 years old. And you would think that, you know, she did indeed grieve for her husband. But just weeks after the funeral, she sent a shipment of 25,000 bottles to Russia, which is pretty extraordinary, not just because of the time period and the fact that she had just lost her husband. It was also during the Napoleonic Wars, and there was a blockade on. So she was being bold, unconventional, and very aggressive in terms of her export strategy, if you will. And it worked. She got her champagne into Russia. It was the champagne they used to toast the birth of the new czar, which made it very fashionable. And then subsequently, great writers like Pushkin and Gogol and Chekhov all wrote about Veuve Clicquot's champagne.
Huh. A brilliant marketing move.
It is. It is. These women they were so unconventional for the time. So you had these aggressive export strategies. They hired smart sales managers to manage different markets internationally. They didn't just stick to France. Another widow, Pommery, came up with the first dry champagne. Until she created it, all champagnes were sweet and typically consumed at the end of a meal. But Madame Pommery recognized that the Brits, the British in particular, loved dry champagne just as they loved their Bordeaux and their Burgundy. So she came up with the first brut, or sauvage, meaning savage. They were kind of critical of the British taste. But that's what it meant. It meant dry champagne, and which totally changed the style of champagne and when we consume it.
Huh. You also said something in the article that the widow Clicquot invented something called riddling, and she did it with her kitchen table.
She did. Trust a woman to use what's at hand.
Yeah, yeah.
The way bubbly gets its bubbles, as you know, is the second fermentation that happens inside the bottle. And up until Madame Clicquot invented riddling, champagnes were very cloudy. No one minded much because there wasn't another option.
Uh-huh.
But what Madame Clicquot did was she had this creative idea to drill holes in her kitchen table, and she stood the bottles upside down. So they were corked with a temporary cork,
right,
kind of a metal cap as you would for beer. Yeah. And so what happened is the sediment, the stuff that was making the champagne cloudy, eventually settled into the neck of the champagne bottle. And then she put that in cold, icy water, disgorged it, got it out, just the little plug of sediment.
Ah.
And then her champagnes, were the first clear, beautiful, clear champagnes that, again, had another marketing advantage because of the way they looked.
Very interesting.
Absolutely. But eventually, Madame Clicquot wanted her kitchen table back. So she eventually invented pupitres, you know, those sort of upright wooden bottle holders that you often see in cellars.
Oh, yeah, they're on a slant, and the
that's
bottles
right,
are
that's
vertical.
Right.
They're put into the holes.
Exactly.
Same idea, though, as the kitchen table. Hey, Natalie, thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Lynn, my pleasure.
Natalie McLean is author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over, A Wine-Soaked Journey from Grape to Glass. And by the way, Natalie's favorite match with champagne is potato chips. And if this sounds vaguely familiar, it's because this food and wine pairing was Marilyn Monroe's creation in the movie 7-Year Itch. Find information on Natalie's other wine and food pairings on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is,